WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM. It is The Big Picture. Derek Gary and Lisa Nichols with you until 9 o'clock tonight. 855-915-9636 is the telephone number. 855-915-9636. Call that number to complain. Call that number to agree with us. Call that number. We love having you on the show. If you want an easier way to remember it, 855-915-WMFO.
Nice and easy for
That's
you.
A great phone number, isn't it? Coming up later tonight, actual issues are going to be harmed because we're going to take a look at where the candidates stand. That would be Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton on some significant issues.
Yeah, you know what? This election cycle, a lot of journalists really not doing their job, but you and I, we are doing our job. So that's why we're here.
By my count, no issues have been harmed in the election coverage in more than 10 days now.
Really?
Ever since the Donald Trump talking lewdly about women audio tape came out, there has been no policy discussion, no issue discussion, none of that.
Hmm. And you would think, you know, the days leading up to the election, that would be what everybody wants to know or what would be on everybody's mind.
I maintain that the safest thing we can do for women in the United States is elect Donald Trump president, because then he will have Secret Service around him all the time and they can keep him away from the women.
There you go. He's like building a wall around himself.
Yes. We need to build a wall.
Sexual wall.
Around Donald Trump so that he does not have access to the women.
Mm-hmm. Just this force.
Yeah. But there are other ways of achieving that same goal, which are less pleasant.
Yeah.
So we're going to get into that after we get through the news tonight. And we're going to talk about domestic policy. We're going to talk about foreign policy. And trust me, you're going to want to listen to this. Don't tune out because, they're going to be talking about policy. You're watching the debate at 9 o'clock. I will guarantee right now, very little of what we discuss tonight will actually be brought up in the debate.
Yes,
the debate will largely consist of Hillary Clinton saying you're a sexist and Donald Trump saying you're a liar.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to go on for an hour and a half.
How many shows have we had where
entertaining?
It was post, either the Republican debates or the Democratic debates and now going into the third. We come the show after and say, why were these questions not asked?
Yeah.
But that's why we're here. We're going to ask them.
So,
and we're going to ask them to each other, not the actual candidates. But, hey, we're doing it.
So you can spend an hour and a half listening to them call each other names. Mm-hmm. Or you can get actual policy information
and plus,
here.
Our pre-show to the debate is far more entertaining than anything that you're going to see on the Clinton News Network or Fox News.
Absolutely.
Or any of the other ones.
We say words like damn and poo.
Hmm.
Which you will not hear come out of either candidate's name.
Yeah, we get aggressive.
Mouth tonight. Yeah. Horse shirt. We say that on this show. What well, is the producer? I need a producer. Lisa, what do we got going on in this state?
Well, today in local news, we learned Boston City Council looks for solutions for parking woes. Mounting anger over Boston's parking congestion is leading to a clash on City Hall, with old school members of the council demanding more parking spaces, while newer councilors want fewer cars, as a major city study on the hot button issue is set for release. At the council hearing on Tuesday, Boston's chief of streets, Chris Osgood, said his department was working on a multi-pronged initiative that would direct new parking revenue towards community investment. Osgood did not give the exact figure for the proposed increase, but said a pilot program would be presented to the City Council by the end of the year. City traffic officials said that the major transportation study, including a map of parking spaces and regulations, will be released later this fall as a part of Go Boston 2030 plan. Osgood said the study would give officials a better understanding of how to change policy. There are about 100,000 residential parking permits in Boston, City Council officials had said. Osgood said the city has been working to making parking, quote, more convenient, better managed, and less needed, end quote. But he would not say if officials were pushing for less car ownership in the city. Leaders are also considering a proposal to increase parking meters in some Boston areas. So not only are we going to be paying more, because you know it's going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to be, so instead of for a quarter, you get 12 minutes. What, we're going to get 5 minutes for a quarter?
10.
Maybe, yeah.
Because that kicks you up to 6 quarters an hour instead of 5.
Mm-hmm.
There's an extra quarter an hour.
Now, if you read a little more into the minutes of said council meeting, it's plays like a soap opera. Exactly like how Boston Chief of Streets Chris Osgood said. He didn't get into details in some of his interviews, but from what I understand, you have all of these old school counselors, which normally I harp on for being in term for too long. They're a little more understanding on what the city needs. We need more parking spaces. Everything is being so overrun by residential areas, and these residential new buildings require parking spaces. So should we put limits on the number of parking spaces that they're allowed space-wise?
No, you should put a wall around the city of Boston and forget about it, because nobody from the suburbs is going into the city anymore because there's no parking.
Well, it's true. But now you have all the new school city councilor members start talking about climate change, and, you know, they're putting on their tinfoil hats and everybody's crazy and we need to get rid of cars.
Yeah.
That's essentially what is happening.
Yeah.
So you have old school, they're saying we need more parking spaces. New school saying, forget the cars, everybody carpool. Let's live in this perfect bubble that, you know, the future of Boston is in the innovation district, and let's charge more people, but we don't want more cars in the city. I'm not sure if there is some sort of bubble on City Hall and they haven't really come out of it to see what's going on. But people are driving in the city because why? Our transportation is crap. It doesn't run. So you need to. We live in Boston. It's not like everybody can walk or bike or take public transportation to work every day.
Why not, Lisa?
Because
why
it
not?
Doesn't run. If you, members of the city council, can get together with your buddies in, you know, the high ups in Boston and have a transit system that can run, then maybe your magical land of having less cars in the city can actually work.
Yeah. Even if it ran.
Where do they think we are?
Even if it ran, the public transit system doesn't go to most of the places where people live on the outskirts of the city.
Exactly.
You got to take a bus.
Look at what's going on right now in the Seaport District where I work. If you want to walk to my work, which is right on the water, closest T station is South Station, which is on the Silver Line.
Yeah.
You can get to a few of them, but it's a mess.
That's more than a mile, isn't it?
It's about a mile and a quarter.
Yeah, that's a good walk.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good walk.
Yeah, how about in 3 feet of snow? How's that walk?
Yeah.
Yeah, that takes about 4 hours, because I used to do it from my apartment in South Boston.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't get to work. Because one, the streets weren't plowed. So also, if you want to run a transit system in the snow, how about plowing some streets?
Yeah, not going to.
No,
because
my tax dollars don't go to that.
No, listen, this is it. They don't want cars in the city. And yet, this has been the plan in Boston for a long time. If we eliminate the parking, people will stop driving here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they've done. At the same time, they have been steadily increasing the residential real estate in the city of Boston at the same time that the universities have been expanding their footprint in the city of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Universities and apartments generate a lot more traffic. So you can't even blame this. It's not like we're putting up office buildings all over town. It's not like there's all these new office high-rises all over the place.
No, it's residential.
It's residential.
Mm-hmm.
And residential property comes with, guess what, cars. Because some people don't want to be stuck in the city of Boston all the time.
No, a majority of these residential buildings are, if you're looking at, what, $2,000+ of rent, for the majority, these people have cars and take them around.
But the vision is, you live in Boston, you never leave Boston. Everything you have is right here in Boston. Unless you want a supermarket, those are all out in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of neighborhoods in Boston that don't have any supermarkets, which is ridiculous. The only major city in the country that I can think of that has this problem. So you've already got the parking problem partly solved, because everybody who lives out in the suburbs knows, don't go in there. That's the rule. Don't go in there. You take a look at what happens after rush hour. You don't see anybody heading from the north into the city.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see anybody from the south heading into the city. They know better. The people who are going around in the city are the people who live in the city. Every one of the burbs, we're staying out in the burbs. You know why? Free parking. Everywhere you go, free parking. We love that.
And ample parking.
Yeah, tons of parking.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things is, I've been in Boston quite a bit lately, and I've had no trouble finding parking.
Mm-hmm.
There actually seems to be more parking in the city now than there was a year or two ago. Mostly because, I believe, everybody in the suburbs, as I said, has caught on.
Now, what area are you going to?
Post Office Square, Kenmore Square. I get around different parts mm-hmm. of the city.
No, I'm thinking about the last time, just in the past month, going to a Red Sox game and to a concert. There's no way you can find parking without being charged $50, $60, the parking rate. And every single time, going down into Brookline, it is a little bit of a walk.
Brookline's a nightmare. Forget about that.
But I found parking easily.
Yeah.
So before, a few years ago, but you're exactly right. If you go again into the seaport, all the streets are being taken up by new construction. So, we went from, say, 5,000 parking spaces, now down to a quarter of that. You're down to maybe like 1,500 parking spaces.
Saturday night, found parking right across the street from Long Wharf, near Faneuil Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Free, because it's a commercial space that doesn't apply on Saturdays. Monday night, found parking right around the corner from One Devonshire, where a friend of mine lives, on the street. Had to pay for an hour of parking. That was it. And it's like, it's there. You hit the city at the right time of day, you can get parking for anything. But at the same time, in both of these cases, I don't have a lot of people around me coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody who's in the city is on foot because they live in the city.
Well, now some of the also conversations that are going on within this meeting was talking about restricting the number of parking permits that they release. So, are we going to get to a situation where now every city is allotted only a certain numbers? When you have a city that is increasing residential, but then you're also making, a ceiling, a cap for the amount of parking stickers that you're giving out, are we going to have now people like a black market for having a parking pass?
Of course you are. Of course you are. And the reality is...
Or also, we understand, though, how much Boston continually just drains money from everybody in the city. So are they going to say, hey, well, if you want a parking pass, it's going to cost you $120. It's going to cost you $200. Oh, you live in the theater district. That's a more higher income, so it's going to be $300.
Look at what Boston is doing, and look at what Boston is doing wrong. Boston was congested 20 years ago. Very badly congested 20 years ago. Since then, there has been a massive surge in development. And all of this development has been geared around tearing down 2- and 3-story buildings and putting up 30- and 40-story buildings.
Mm-hmm.
When you add that many people into the space, you just increase the congestion. There's no room for all the cars that would normally come along with these
people.
Well,
that sounds like pretty basic math.
Yeah.
A normal person could figure that out.
Boston isn't big enough to do what Boston is doing in terms of expanding its residential base. It doesn't have the space for all those people.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, every time you turn around, well, here's another 50-story condo.
Mm-hmm.
Here's another 40-story apartment building.
South Boston's a perfect example of that. You also see it in the Longwood Medical area, where you had, some small businesses, some residential buildings, again, as you just said, 2 and 3 stories high. And now everywhere you look, everything's being built on. I have a friend that had a beautiful apartment in South Boston, right near the convention center. Amazing view of the city. Of course, 2 months later, they put up a brick wall right in front of the view.
Yeah.
So you have a roof deck that you can't even use because you look in somebody's window. So.
Yeah.
But it's happening all over the city. Where's the max? I feel like right now we have this mindset, or at least people in City Hall have this mindset, and, Marty Walsh is really pushing on this. It's coming from Menino's, administration as well. But he's pushing for more. Why? Because it's more jobs. More jobs for who? Union workers.
Right. Well, this is the Kevin White approach to urban revitalization, which is throw skyscrapers all over the place. Mm-hmm. And for Marty Walsh, it's a way to make sure that those juicy union construction jobs keep flowing.
Yeah, because, of course, for the person looking in, it says, oh, Marty Walsh is creating jobs for people. We understand who they're creating jobs for.
Yeah.
And he's making more people come into the city and make it more profitable for the businesses.
But you don't necessarily do that, because here's the other side of it, okay? You don't have enough room for everybody to get around.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have enough. There's no parking anymore. And so I know there are some bad neighborhoods. There's no room for everybody to park once you build all this stuff. Boston does not have the public transportation infrastructure that a New York City does or a Washington, D.C. does that is going to allow you to connect neighborhoods in meaningful ways.
Of course. And if you're living day to day, and after a few years, you realize, is this worth being in the city for all this congestion?
No.
You know, look back 20 years ago. People never left the city because it was good. You could move around. You could get to and from places. You could go somewhere without waiting for 4 hours. People are leaving the city. I've been in the city for so long, and I'm like, I'm ready to go back to the burbs.
People who have the money are getting out, and they're going to the suburbs because everything you need is out there. The only reason anyone in the city or anyone in the suburbs has to go into the city is you're going to see the Red Sox, you're going to see the Bruins or the Celtics, or you're going to the Pops.
Well, there was that connotation because everybody went to the city. There's more options, whether it be dining,
not
shopping.
Anymore.
Exactly.
I go to the Native Collection. The everything that's in Boston is there.
You're looking just at the food scene. You have major Boston chefs that are moving outside to the burbs. Because why? People are deciding, again, you don't need to go into the city. We can still make the same amount of money that we do with our business in the city right out here.
They actually make more.
There's a demand for it.
They actually make more money because the rents are lower. The license fees are lower. There's less city headache in operating your business, unless you're in summer. You know, further out you get, the easier it is to operate that business. And there's parking. So you have, if you have a good restaurant, you're full every single night. Go try and get near Turner's. Go try and get near Turner's dinner time any day of the week. Can't do it. Go try and get near Giacomo's and Melrose any night of the week. Can't do it. These restaurants, Felicia's and Stoneham, try and get near that. Can't do it. These restaurants that have moved out to the suburbs are hugely successful because there is a very large population that will drive to go get good food and knows that there is parking that they're not going to have to pay for. And there's none of that headache of going into the city and tripping over people and spending $50 for parking and trying to figure out where the heck you're going. Mm-hmm. Everything's right there for you.
You're exactly right.
And this is, I see this happening in community after community. Every suburb around here right now is rebuilding their main streets around restaurants. Restaurants are the big thing. Mm-hmm. And every city and town is competing to get the good ones now. And there's certain level of retail that's
following
around
that.
Well,
look at the large developments. Dedham was really the first one to push that. And then you had the Hingham Marketplace and then Market Street in Linfield.
You can't get near it.
And you go any night to Assembly Row. I'm amazed. I wonder how much, does anybody work? Because regardless if it's a Sunday night or a Friday night, people are there till close.
Yeah. And we're not
every single restaurant is filled.
And we're not talking about little storefront bistros. We're talking about big, you know, Fenway Park, Boston Garden size dining establishments.
No, but
that
it's
are
also
full of people.
You know, it's also the shopping too, because if you have an outlet store that normally would be placed in a mall, but then they have the option of going on Boylston Street or Newbury Street, which used to be, oh, you come into Boston, where do you want to go shopping? Oh, the Prudential Center or Copley Newbury Street. That's where everybody goes. Why now?
Yeah.
You can go over to Somerville, get the same exact stores, same exact products without the headaches. And again, free parking.
Listen, let them get rid of their parking, build a wall around the city with a tunnel so 93 can get through, and we'll just be done with it. And everybody in Boston can stay in Boston and do whatever they're doing, and everyone out in the suburbs can have a good time.
I like it.
Sensible. In national news, in New York City, Deborah Danner is dead, and Police Commissioner James O'Neill said the police had failed. Officers were called to Danner's Bronx apartment at 6 p.m. Tuesday in response to a report of a woman behaving erratically. An unidentified white police sergeant entered the apartment of Danner, who was black, and found her armed with a pair of scissors. The sergeant convinced Danner to drop the scissors, but when she picked up a bat and threatened the officer, he shot her twice in the torso. Police had previously encountered Danner, who had mental health needs. The sergeant has been placed on modified duty pending an investigation, including why he failed to use his taser. Speaking to reporters last night, Commissioner O'Neill said, quote, "We do have policies and procedures for handling emotionally disturbed people, and it looks like some of those procedures weren't followed. What is clear in this one instance is we failed," end quote. Interesting that he threw the phrase "one instance" in there, because this is Commissioner O'Neill basically saying, yeah, we screwed up this one time. You screwed up more than the one time. This is the latest time. And once again, we have a police officer encountering a mentally ill person and using deadly force against a baseball bat.
Well, again, regardless of the mental illness, if we take the mental illness out of it, at what point did that cop fear his life so much where he thought that instead of reaching for his taser, he reached for his gun? You said shot in the abdomen. From what I understood, I thought it was shot in the shoulder.
Torso.
It was shoulder, chest, or shoulder, torso?
Torso is everything in the middle here.
Okay.
Below your neck and above your waist. So.
But again, there's this on so many levels. So first I say, why did he reach for his gun? Second of all, why do you have to kill somebody? Why are you shooting for a second time? Is it not enough to maim somebody by shooting them in the shoulder? Because, you know, if you're taking in any sort of suspect that you want answers from, terrorism and whatnot, you're going to shoot them but try to keep them alive. She had a baseball bat. And I mean,
She's 66 years old, by the way.
Yes. So I play in a softball league, and many of the girls in my softball league have a really great swing. But I'm sure a guy could grab a bat or take down a bat from somebody, a girl's hand.
I'm not too afraid of...
Without having to shoot them.
Here's the thing. I'm not too afraid of an adult male with a baseball bat.
Because
unless he hits me in the head, I'm going to survive that. It may hurt. Probably isn't even going to break a bone, okay? Even if he hits me in the head, unless he's really strong, he's not going to knock me out with it.
But this is what you're trained for.
This is number one, okay? First of all, I'm not in mortal fear of somebody swinging a baseball bat unless it's The Walking Dead and it's covered in barbed wire. And I know he's deliberately going to smash my skull in with it. Number two, he's in an apartment, which means it's close quarters, so... Why don't you just shoot to stop? Shoot her in the leg. That's probably going to get her to stop swinging the bat.
But again, Derek, why are we even getting to a point where you need to take out the gun?
Number three, why don't you just back out of the apartment? Why don't you just back off in that situation? Wait for some backup to come in. Back off, back up. That should be the rule for these cops, all right? You get into the situation, back off. Wait for backup.
Mm-hmm. And in this cop, including all the cops on the force, they undergo training that has proper handling of this sort of situation with mental illness. And again, as I say, even if you put the mental illness aside, why are you even shooting at somebody? But you just said it. You're in close quarters and you have somebody with a bat. You are trained for combat. You are trained to take somebody down. What are you scared? Why are you scared?
And that brings up that point again, which is here is another...
If I felt like my life was at risk and somebody was coming at me with a baseball bat and I had nothing on me, I could probably take them down somehow. Whether you're kicking somebody or you know, grabbing the net, something, is it not better to do maybe harder force than shooting somebody and killing somebody?
The one possible out... that you have in this situation is that he thought he had his taser and not his gun. And when he pulled the trigger, he was expecting the taser and not the gun. And there was some controversy a couple of years back about the design of the taser being too similar to the design of a handgun.
How many times are we going to use that as an excuse?
Why is the handle of the taser the same as the handle of a handgun? That's the better question. Why hasn't that been fixed? That has not been fixed, by the way. But that's the only possible out.
Again, this is your job. This is your job to know that my taser is on my left-hand side and my gun's on my right-hand side. And then, oops, I accidentally shoot when somebody has a bat in front of me.
Yeah.
You are... not proficient at your job.
No.
You are.
This is an 8-year veteran, but they haven't given a name or anything. This is an 8-year veteran. This is a sergeant. So this is a guy who's been promoted a couple of times, who theoretically knows what he's doing, but demonstrated no knowledge of what he was doing at all in this situation last night. Why do we keep having this conversation? What is going on with the cops? Because the one constant in all of this is the cops. Jumpy cops shooting people. Why are the cops jumpy? Why are they shooting everybody?
Mm-hmm.
And why is this happening all over the country? This isn't even something that, oh, you know, you can point to this one part of the country. I mean, it's like, if it was contained to one area.
It's happening everywhere.
You could say, you know what, that's bad training down there. Or maybe you have a racial problem down there that you need to look at. State that used to oppress black people until the 1960s. This is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
This is all over the country. We have people shooting citizens who don't pose a lethal threat to anyone. It has to stop.
Because especially with the most recent conversations that we've had about this, there is no possible way that I can even defend this.
No. There's no way anybody...
Because we don't have a situation where the victim has tried to attack the cop, went forcefully, because again, you don't know what you're going to expect when you're charging with a weapon at a cop, a gun. We have a different circumstance when we're dealing with a bat. We're dealing with scissors. Again, you had a cop that convinced a woman to drop the scissors.
Right.
Now she has a bat.
Which is less dangerous to you than the scissors. Because I can't stab you with a bat.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. You don't.
It's crazy. Like it's. But that's what it is. It's laughable.
You can't.
It's so incredibly sad that it's laughable that this is a state of what is going on.
You can't defend this. I gave the one out, which is he thought it was a taser, not the gun. But I can't defend this. The New York City Police Commissioner can't defend this. In this one instance, we failed. That's what he said. We failed.
And we failed is not an apology. It's not. What is happening to change this? Because again, we have this conversation over and over again. What is happening to change this? What are these cities doing? Nothing so far.
As it is. I think asking for the apology.
What, stripping the badge?
I think asking,
and your gun?
No. I think asking for the apology is too much. Because as it is, what Commissioner O'Neill said is going to trigger a wrongful death suit against New York City police that the city of New York is probably going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
That's why these officials never say anything. That was some of the most blunt language I have heard from a police officer regarding one of these shootings. And for Commissioner O'Neill, this is really a question of keeping a lid on this. Because there have been protests in New York. Those protests have been peaceful. But there have also been police officers in New York targeted and killed by people upset at police shootings in other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sitting on a powder keg there. It may not look like it from what we see on the news, but you got a lot of angry people walking around in that city.
You have angry people on both sides.
And if you don't come out and get in front of it, you could have riots mm-hmm. on your hands. And if that...
Well, this is what we've been seeing in so many cities. We've seen it in Baltimore. We saw it in Ferguson. We saw it in L.A. And fear set in last Wednesday when we got out of the show. And at night, I got an alert that two officers were shot in East Boston. There is anger on both sides.
Yeah.
There is more anger, I think, on African Americans wondering why black people are being shot. This is a conversation that's happening over and over again. And again, nothing's changing.
No, because no one is addressing the root cause of the problem, which is the militarization of the police. That has to be addressed. And nobody has stepped forward and put forward a plan to address that. Now, as it is, Commissioner O'Neill probably cost the city $20 million by saying we failed last night. Because that's about where the wrongful death suit is probably going to come in.
Because mm-hmm.
the family's going to file for $100 million. And the lawyers and the insurance companies are going to come
settle.
In. And they're going to settle. They're going to settle for somewhere between $15 and $20 million in this case. Because this looks like gross negligence on the part of the police. And maybe a few of these $20 million lawsuits will put a stop to this sort of thing. I don't think so. You know, Commissioner O'Neill has gambled $20 million against what the cost would be if you had a full-on riot in that city, which, believe me, is way more than $20 million. But that's why we never hear these cops say anything about this, is the second you open your mouth and say, we screwed up, or our cops did a bad thing, boom, wrongful death suit.
Mm-hmm. Attorney General's being called, there's a federal investigation.
Yep. instant wrongful death suit, millions of dollars of liability. Mm-hmm. So for him to come out and say something that forceful and that honest says, first of all, we're concerned that this could blow up in a really, really bad way. And second of all, yeah, we screwed up here. And it's nice to see that kind of blunt talk for a change.
Because you're not getting that in so many places.
But keep in mind that that blunt talk is partly a result of a desire to prevent this situation from becoming much worse than it currently is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a desire to try and preserve peace between the police and the community in New York City.
Because this is where rioting starts. When you have an incident like this and somebody is shot and you have the police coming out and not giving the verbiage that the community wants or is not enough, they're angry.
We'll see if it
works. Baton Rouge is a perfect example.
Yeah.
One of the latest. Because what was the message that we were getting from the cops? Oh, we don't know what happened.
Yeah. We're not going to show you the video. Too bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So hopefully everything stays calm in New York City. It's nice to see some candor for the police. But keep in mind, this isn't just about admitting that we made a mistake. This is about trying to prevent things from escalating in that city. And this is WMFO Medford. In world news, talk of peace remains in the air in Afghanistan. Two senior Taliban officials told Reuters that they met with representatives of the Afghan government and United States officials in Qatar earlier this month for informal peace talks. The exact role of the U.S. officials is unknown, and the talks did not lead to any breakthroughs. The Afghan government is demanding that the Taliban declare an immediate ceasefire, lay down all weapons, and begin formal peace talks. The Taliban is demanding recognition as a political party in Afghanistan, the release of all prisoners, and the removal of leaders' names from a United Nations blacklist.
Oh, the Taliban's political party now?
This one kind of...
I never thought that you would say the sentence Taliban and peace talks.
This one kind of snuck out on Monday, and apparently, yeah, you know, the Obama administration is still trying to negotiate an end to this thing over there. Mm-hmm. I think President Obama would like to solve that before he leaves office, which would be a major achievement. The Taliban's demands are actually not out of line with where these things usually begin. Inevitably, the opposition wants political recognition. This happened with the Irish Republican Army.
Mm-hmm.
This is happening with the FARC rebels in Colombia. It's pretty much, it happens with the Scottish when they threaten to secede. It's pretty much standard operating position that you're going to ask for that. The release of all prisoners, not going to happen. The removal of leaders' names from a UN blacklist, maybe some, but, you know, you're largely considered a sponsor of terror, Taliban. And as long as you hold that reputation, you're going to be on the no-fly list. But these sides may not be as far apart as everything seems. And if you look on both sides, these really aren't, other than the release of all prisoners, these really aren't completely unreasonable demands to begin peace negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a feeling that this story has floated out at this particular moment in time, basically as a heads up to everyone that, yes, something is happening in Afghanistan. We're trying to coax it along, and the world is watching.
Now, the question that I pose to you is, what's the point? I mean, clearly this has been going on for a while, but are we talking about, are they threatening to make more terrorist attacks here in the United States? Is there trying to be some sort of compromise to...
The Taliban hasn't really been in the international terrorism business that mm-hmm. much. Most of what they're doing...
And because, of course, everything that we've been hearing has been about ISIS. And not that anybody forgets about the Taliban, because they are still ruling... There's still cells all around Afghanistan
right.
with members in them. And there's workings. Not necessarily terrorist attacks in the works, but...
They still control most of the north of Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
and they look at the Afghani government as a puppet of the United States, which to some extent it is, because that's the government that we install, that's the government that we prop up. But this is the Taliban basically coming down out of the mountains and saying, yeah, we're getting a little tired of the fighting here. Maybe there's an opening to negotiate some kind of future shared coalition government.
Or do you think it's more so the empowering of ISIS and them taking over more and more of the Middle East and everything that's going on with trying to fight them. And they're, again, not completely useless, but...
Practically speaking, what's happened over there is... it's important to, first of all, know that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda weren't the same thing. The Taliban were providing a safe haven for Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
But Al-Qaeda was a separate organization, multinational organization.
But the Taliban was funding Al-Qaeda. To an extent.
They were providing safe haven. They were providing...
There were also arms going into the Middle East, and yes, Taliban was supplying that.
They were facilitating the movement of arms, but primarily because they controlled the land. Not because they had any sort of deep and abiding love.
They were essentially contractors and...
Not really.
No, land purveyors?
No, it's more like a better way to think about it is, you know, think about the government of Malden, all right? Government of Malden decides, you know what? We're going to let the anti-Spain party set up shop here. We're going to move in the Basque rebels.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to let the Basques just operate out of Malden. Anything they need, we're going to give them, but we're not going to go fight with them. We're not going to go commit terrorist acts or anything like that. But we're going to let them stay here. You know, if somebody sends them some arms, we'll get them over there. If they need public housing, we'll pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much what the Taliban was doing with Al-Qaeda. Once the war was on, the war was really... Because Al-Qaeda packed up and left as soon as the United States started dropping bombs. They went and hid in Pakistan. The war was between the United States and the Taliban over who was going to be in charge in Afghanistan. And it was basically a policy of regime change on the part of the United States because the Taliban had provided safe haven for our terrorist enemies.
Mm-hmm.
We put the government in. The Taliban still wants... They've got this sort of same caliphate idea that ISIS has. They want Sharia law. They want fundamentalist Islam to be the rule of the land.
So do we work with them until we understand the point of what they're going to do again with the land in Afghanistan? And then do we... this brings us back to how much is too much of our getting involved in what's going on in Afghanistan?
Well, this is where it goes, because Al-Qaeda's left. The Taliban is pretty much the only game in town if you want a job. Then ISIS shows up, and ISIS is throwing money around like crazy. Suddenly, the Taliban can't afford to keep an army anymore.
So that's why I ask you, is this happening because of what's going on with ISIS?
It's happening because ISIS...
It's a coincidence, no?
It's not a coincidence. It's happening because ISIS has been weakened. But the Taliban has also been weakened. And given a choice, young men are opting to go with ISIS rather than the Taliban. So the Taliban is now in a position where they can't really fight the United States, mm-hmm, and the Afghan government anymore. And they're coming in and they're saying, hey, what do you say we stop with the suicide bombings and the car bombings and the shooting at each other and the hiding in Pakistan all winter?
And just leave us alone in Afghanistan. Let us rule our land. Recognize us as a political power, and so be it.
Yeah.
So then what? They build up again? You know, a few years later down the line, do we keep eyes on them and making sure that they don't get too strong? Because then there's our involvement again in a country that we shouldn't be involved in.
If the Afghan people want to live in a fundamentalist Islamic state ruled by Sharia law, that's their choice. And no matter what the United States does,
no, absolutely,
that's going to happen.
And I'm not blocking that. What I'm saying is, are we going to get to where they build up again? They start bringing in what? Al-Qaeda's gone. So are we going to bring in ISIS, support them, and you have another power? I'm thinking maybe so far down the line, but there's a possibility.
I think it's more of a case where the Taliban has a seat at the table. The Afghan government has a seat at the table, which means the United States has a seat at the table. And they try and negotiate some sort of government,
mm-hmm,
to move forward from this. Yes, they're probably going to tip over into fundamentalism very, very quickly. But again, not our problem.
It's what we see so much, though, in the Middle East, where you have a country or some sort of political power that is backing or supplying a terrorist group or force, trying to keep their own hands clean. And then they come to the United States and say, no, let's take a seat at the table. Let's have some sort of compromise. Iran, perfect example of that.
But it's... Iran gets complicated too. In the case of Afghanistan, though, it is better to have to deal with a single government over there, even if it's doing things that you don't like, than to have the country in its current state, where half of it is under one government and the other half of it is under another government, and they're constantly at war with each other.
So we have to give up some things that we maybe don't like to compromise,
right? Because
for the better of the relationship.
The current environment provides a fertile ground for groups like ISIS to hide and consolidate power. If you have a single unified government, even if it's a coalition government, it is much harder for groups like ISIS to come in and stick themselves in the middle of a war and have a safe base of operations. And if you've got international cooperation, other governments keeping an eye on what's going on over there, and you see, hey, somebody in this province is letting ISIS get started up, then you have the authority to negotiate with that government, which is basically what we do with Pakistan, and say to them, look, either you get rid of those guys over there, or we're going to get rid of those guys over there, and you know what it's going to be like if we get rid of those guys over there. So it is in our best interest to have that single coalition government in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. It would be nice to see this happen, because that would at least take one war off the planet.
No, and again, and you say that so many times, it's better for the United States to have a seat at the table, have some sort of negotiation and talks, and be involved in it without being pushed aside and not understanding what's going on in the region.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Well, today in sports, we're asking the question again, shouldn't student athletes be paid? Wisconsin player Nigel Hayes made a bold statement during ESPN's College Game Day visit to Madison, Wisconsin on Saturday, carrying a sign asking people to send money to an online account. Hayes told ESPN that he wanted to, quote, create conversation about compensation for college athletes. All funds will be given to the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, according to Hayes. Hayes has previously spoken about the NCAA and Big Ten's financial treatment of student athletes. On Friday, he sent a series of tweets comparing the revenue taken in for college athletics to the value of his scholarship. He followed up with Saturday by saying student athletes deserve more than their current stipend, for in that each institution, not the NCAA, should have the power to pay its athletes appropriate compensation. Former Ohio State running back Maurice Claret posted support for Hayes' message on his social media, saying that, quote, it takes courage for somebody to do something like this. This conversation will be continued to have. It's my hope that one day all college kids decide to sit out of sports and school until someone negotiates new circumstances for them. Then when you disrupt the money, you will get people's attention, end quote. Hayes, a senior, was named Big Ten Player of the Year after averaging 15.7 points and 5.8 rebounds per game last year. This is a conversation that we've had many times on the show, and we disagree, I believe, for the most part.
My position on this has been very consistent. Anything that involves a student's name or a likeness should be compensated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Same way it would be in any other walk of life. This is the one area in our public and overly marketed world in the United States, where someone can use your name and likeness and not compensate you in any way for it. That's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
As far as getting paid, you're a college athlete. You don't get paid.
Absolutely.
You get a scholarship, end of story.
Well, you know, this is something, and regardless if it's NCAA, basketball, football, there's always going to be athletes that are going to try to propose being paid.
Sure.
Because, of course, and
who don't want money?
Who was that?
You find me an 18 or 19 year old that would not like to have $1 million.
What was that last year? The UConn player was Shabazz.
Yeah,
he had written a piece. I forget who it was for.
He was starving,
but he was saying that he was a college athlete. The number one player in college basketball was going to bed starving every night.
Yeah,
I can tell you, I played college athletics. I had some money paid into it, and you do not starve. Trust me.
Can we talk about...
So I'm talking about D1 lacrosse at a small school in Rhode Island compared to UConn, top-seeded basketball team. You're not starving.
Can we talk about this?
It's crazy.
For me, the single greatest example of the unfair treatment of these college athletes is the fact that Jameis Winston had to shoplift lobster to eat. He had to walk into a public store and steal lobsters.
I believe that was king crab legs. They were frozen from Publix in Florida.
I thought it was lobsters.
I think it was king crab
legs. Was it crab legs? He had to steal king crab legs to eat. Why aren't they feeding our college athletes? Mm-hmm. Why aren't they being fed?
But again,
why do they have to steal their crab legs?
I differ from your opinion in saying that if you go into the school store and... or you go into Modell's down the street. We have one right here. You buy a BC football t-shirt, a jersey, and it has a player's name on it. I don't believe that player should be compensated.
Oh, I absolutely think they should.
I believe that, especially when you were in college, given the chances, and I understand how much, how many millions of dollars these institutions are being made. But when you go into college, many of these players would never ever get the opportunity to go to these schools, Harvard, Princeton, Yale. You can go on.
They're still going to make millions of dollars. I just want to see a cut go to the student athletes.
What is happening in college when you are at this superior level of playing? You are setting up yourself for your brand, which is going to carry you post-college. Whether that takes you into the NBA, that takes you to the NFL. And there are a lot of players that are top seeded that do not go into the pros.
Not if your patella gets ripped off. Not if you have to have your spine fused.
But I think that student athletes, some of them, if they get their opportunity to have a sponsor, which I believe is not allowed by NCAA, they should be allowed to be sponsored, whether it be Dasani water or whatnot.
That I disagree
then
with.
Then they can get the money for it.
That I disagree with completely. Sponsorships should not be going to individual college athletes. That shouldn't be happening, because that is a needless corruption of the game, which is supposed to be about pure sport. You are not a professional. I understand some of these kids have huge social media followings and all these companies are glomming in there.
But again, you're not only setting yourself up as, you know, to promote yourself as an athlete and market yourself as an athlete, but you're marketing yourself as a brand. And that's what college is for. So all the efforts that you're putting into it, I don't believe if a t-shirt gets sold, you shouldn't get the money for it.
You're not marketing yourself as a brand. You're there to play your game and be good enough to get a pro career.
No, of course.
And anything that happens to build on your legend while you're there is a plus that is immediately going to be forgotten as soon as you get out. I mean, nobody cares about how great anybody was in college in the NFL. All right? It's going to get you looked at by the scouts. It may get you a higher position on draft day.
But as soon as
regular season game takes place, if you don't play well, nobody cares. If you do play well, nobody cares. Your life begins when you sign that contract with an NFL team.
Absolutely. But if we start giving money to students based off of whatever percentage of sales for jerseys and whatnot, then we start getting into bringing on students that are going to make you money. I get it. You're supposed to win a championship.
What college isn't doing that right now?
No, of course they
are. What's the entire recruiting process about? You're going to tell me that Notre Dame isn't deciding?
But I think that no money should be involved when it has to do with the institution. We've had so many problems, and it is going on everywhere. Sports Illustrated, how many investigations have they brought out in different NCAA football teams where you have alumni giving money at the end of the game, giving them $500 in blank envelopes? Of course, that happens. But once you start giving money from the institutions...
This isn't coming from the institutions. This is coming... The institutions don't sell those goods directly.
But it has their name on
it. They license that product to a company that manufactures it.
The company sells it. The school's name on it, and they get a profit.
The company sells it and then returns a portion of those sales to the university as a licensing fee. And those licensing fees are actually negotiated up front.
No, and I understand that.
At the beginning of it. So Nike and the rest of these companies actually take a big risk. If you spend $5
million... But essentially what you have is the institution is making money off of the student.
Yes.
So, yes.
But they're making money off of the student's name and likeness. Not their performance on the field, but their name and likeness.
But
and
they that are gets into a in whole different area. The student.
They're not giving the money to the student.
So what would you propose? What percentage from the sales from a student's name being on a jersey?
It should probably,
say for football.
It should probably be an even split in every sport.
Which, it would never happen.
Which is half of it goes to the university and half of it goes to the student. Because keep in mind, these schools are also making money on ticket sales. They're making money on sponsorship deals. They're making money on television rights. They're getting bonus checks for winning championships.
Yeah.
There is a lot of money flowing into the schools that have good programs.
Yeah, and there's a lot of hidden money that is going into some of these students. So when you have messages like this saying that, and if you want to promote something and promote an online account for a charity, yes, absolutely. But then you start getting into this conversation about that, you know, you're a starving, poor student. Come on. There are so many people across the country that would give a right leg to have the opportunity yeah. to go to the college that you do, yeah. get to play in front of how many thousands of people every single yeah. Friday, and Saturday.
Look, you've got room and board and a career in pro sports ahead of you. Nobody wants to hear about how you're going to be poor for the next 4 years, mm-hmm. okay? Because you got a roof over your head
Harvard's
and three meals a day.
75,000, 80,000 a year now. So they're getting everything paid for, room, board, and...
But at the same time, there is no other aspect, no other situation...
Of course, but you're
United
in
States,
college. You sign your name away.
Other than straight news, where someone can make money off of your name and likeness without compensating you for it. There is no other situation
but
where this
like,
happens.
But it's not like you're not getting anything in return. Again, just like you just said.
You're not getting anything in return.
You are getting...
You're getting that anyway. You're getting that education and that room and board anyway by virtue of being on the team. And you are enabling that school to make $50, $75,
yes.
$100
yes,
million dollars a year.
Yes, but it is more likely for your name to be written on that roster because the college knows they're going to make money off of you. There's a chance if they didn't think they were going to make money off of you that you wouldn't be on the team. So it goes hand in hand.
It doesn't go hand in hand.
It does.
That is the way it's always worked. The difference.
Of course.
The difference is 20, 30 years ago, we didn't have video games that had licensed college players in it. We didn't have licensed player jerseys for college teams. You bought the BC jersey, and that was all you could get was the BC jersey. Okay? You didn't have all of these calendars and other stuff coming out with the star players all over it.
Mm-hmm.
These schools are marketing to their fan bases based on the names and likenesses of their players. Those players actually, under the law, control that. And if you look at any
and other... And that is something that you agree to when you sign your name yeah,
but,
to that contract.
But here's the thing. These kids are well within their rights to challenge that. Just because all of the universities are making them sign that right away doesn't mean that it's legal. It just means that it's the way things are done.
And that's the way that it's always been.
So if these kids want to get paid, what they got to do is go find a lawyer to file a class action suit saying, we want licensing fees for our name and likeness, 50-50 split with the schools. And they will win that
case.
Again,
I just feel like you start getting money involved with the institutions, it can open up a can of worms.
What will happen is the schools will stop selling licensed merchandise. They'll just put the team logo mm-hmm. on there. And that's the end of that. So that ultimately gives the schools a way out of this.
Of course.
But what the schools are doing right now, and your point about, yeah, you get room and board and you know your education, all that. Yeah, I get that.
No, and I understand that.
And the schools get championships and piles of money in exchange for that.
And
where you have to draw the line.
And I respect your opinion for that. I don't agree with it, but that's what makes it different.
Billy Football comes in. He's a national superstar. And the school's making an extra $10 million a year selling Billy Football jerseys. Billy Football should be getting half.
Well, Billy Football, for the 4 years that he is in college, is setting up his brand for the next...
Doesn't matter.
Whatever, 10 years
Billy,
that he is popular
Billy Football
in the NFL.
Billy Football could go straight into the NFL and bypass that whole thing. That's what's happening in the NBA.
Yeah, but how many average players in college athletics move into professional and don't have that notoriety? Look at Jameis Winston, even what a schmuck he is. He moved. His name was huge in the South, in football, in NCAA. How much money he made in his initial rookie year just on his jerseys? Because why? His notoriety, people noticed him and knew the name across the country.
The one sport where it isn't happening right now with any huge regularity is the National Football League. because college football is the minors for the National Football League. And you're not going to get picked up on an NFL team until you got at least 2 years of college under your belt where you're starting every game and they can see what you can do. We have basketball players going from high school into the pros, baseball players going from high school into the pros.
Majority of hockey players.
A lot of hockey players, especially up in Canada, going straight into the pros.
Why? Look at the Bruins. How many players are under 20 years old?
Why am I going to go spend 4 years in college letting somebody else make money off of my name when I can go straight to the pros and make money off my name myself? Mm-hmm. It is a better deal for those kids. In the short term. In the long term, they're risking their knees and their education and their future livelihood.
Yeah, but it's far less likely for somebody to go in and have the popularity going in as an 18-year-old fresh out of high school into the majors or professional.
But a lot of these kids, as soon as they're on that team, boom, they score a couple of goals. Everybody's buying their jersey. Mm-hmm. Look, who's the next big thing?
Yeah, look at the
Torrey Krug,
the number one draft pick in the NHL. I think he scored 4 games in his first game.
Yeah, but look at Torrey Krug.
18 years old.
Nobody knew who that kid was before he came to the Bruins. Scores a couple goals, makes a couple of good plays. Everybody in Boston loves Torrey Krug. Now, if he'd gone to college and played hockey for 4 years, would that have made a difference? I think he did, actually. Mm-hmm. But why? Why would you do it? That's what the universities are missing out on by not cutting this deal with their students. Listen. Yeah, we'll give you a piece of the licensing rights. You're talking about $10,000 a year, maybe $30,000 a year for a kid who's really popular, which is enough to make the students happy, give them some money so they can go buy a new car or buy a gold-plated grill or buy a great 50-inch plasma TV, and everybody's treated fairly. Mm-hmm. That's all. WMFO Medford.
Well, in entertainment news, we learned one person looks to clear their name from an article of lies. A defamation trial against Rolling Stone based on a 2014 article about alleged rape on campus at the University of Virginia got underway in federal court Monday. The magazine retracted the story under scrutiny, revealed inconsistencies. The trial beginning now involves a former dean of school who is suing for $7.85 million in her portrayal on the piece. The 2014 article written by Sabrina Rubin Erdely was explosive. In it, a student identified as Jackie described a brutal gang raping at a fraternity party. Can't talk now. In 2012, followed by a callous indifference from college authorities. Several outlets, including the Washington Post, identified major inconsistencies with the reporting. Soon afterward, Rolling Stone retracted the story, saying the magazine relied too much on Jackie's account and did not adequately work to confirm her story. In the article, Jackie and the alleged assailants were never identified by their real names, but Nicole Arimo, a former associate dean of students, was. Arimo sued for defamation last spring, and she said the article painted her as the chief villain of the story, full of indifference towards sexual assault allegation. Oh, we thought this girl was finally gone.
Whatever happened to that Sabrina Rubin Erdely? Has she been heard from since this whole...
She's working at probably some local newspaper.
I think she's delivering pizza, probably, or driving for Uber, or doing something else where she doesn't have to give anyone her name and past history.
Yeah, we knew this story was going to come back up in understanding the ramifications of the fallout from it.
Yeah.
And that you had a university that was scarred over this completely fake and fabricated story for the only reason that I can understand Sabrina Rubin Erdely had a message that she wanted to send out about sexual assault on campuses. And in that, she believed that rape is rampant in college.
And she got catfished.
And the way that she did that, she found somebody without checking out references. This girl fabricated a story, as we know is Jackie, not her real name. You know, put a black scar on the university, the fraternity, and the students, because the students were known at the, of course, if you're in a college, everybody's going to know who they were.
Yep.
Even though the names weren't mentioned in the story,